Good morning and welcome to this September 7th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on Tumblr. We're on Instagram, all under KUCI FM. So follow us there. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that go into the creation of great fiction. What I should do more of and what I don't do enough of is young adult fiction, which is such a vibrant and growing part of our part of our bookshelves. So today is a perfect opportunity for that. Nora Raleigh Baskin is here with me. And in the second half, Alexander Weinstein will join me to talk about his story collection, Children of the New World, which I am going nuts over, so stay tuned for that. But first, Nora Raleigh Baskin is the author of 13 books. She's an ALA Schneider Family Book Award winning author of Anything But Typical. She was chosen as a Publisher's Weekly Flying Start for her novel What Every Girl Except Me Knows, and has written a number of novels for middle grade and teens, including The Truth About My Bat Mitzvah, The Summer Before Boys, Ruby on the Outside. She was on in 2009 with Barbara for her book All We Know of Love. You can find a podcast of that interview up on our website. In commemoration of the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, her latest novel is 9/10, a September 11th story that is out now. It's published by Athenaeum. Nora lives in Connecticut. She joins me from there now, and it is my huge pleasure to have her back on. Nora, hi.
Hi, thank you for that wonderful introduction.
You've accomplished so much. So it's this is just reading about you. It's amazing. 13 books. Oh. I love it. I love it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And another great one. So, you know, I mean, we're staring down the barrel. You and I were talking a little bit offline about this, of kind of staring down the barrel of this difficult anniversary coming up on Sunday. 15 years, it's hard to believe it's been 15 years. But I wanted to let you kind of take us into the novel and talk about why you felt compelled to write about September 11th and sort of who these characters are and take us into your world a little bit.
Oh, sure. Well, I guess first, what we were saying, I didn't realize it was the 15th anniversary when I began writing this. And in fact, I wrote it years ago. Took about a year to write it and then edit. And by the time my editor and I looked and said at the pub date and said, "Oh wow, it's 2016," we were both taken aback. And I can tell you, when I saw it categorized on Amazon as historical fiction, I was really
wow.
Surprised. It didn't feel like historical fiction, obviously to me or to her. That's been the hugest surprise, is when I'm speaking to kids. I guess the biggest surprise for me in publishing this book has been the difference between talking to adults and talking to kids, and adults that don't want to read it, or adults who are nervous about reading it but want some way to talk to their children about it, and then children who have no history with this, who don't bring any of the emotional, gut-wrenching feelings that we do. So that chasm has been very interesting to me. But in terms of why I wrote it, here's the funny story that's very true. I was watching a movie. I had a contract to write a book, a middle grade novel, and so I'm, you know, thinking what's it going to be, or I never am at a loss for ideas, but I was watching a movie called Bobby, Emilia Estevez movie. Mm. Every time I ask someone, they don't know the movie. Do you know it?
I haven't seen it, but I have heard of it. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I have heard of it.
It's wonderful. It's this amazing all-star cast movie. It's about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, but it's not about that. It takes place the 24 hours before, and it shows several different characters. You probably can tell where I'm going with this. Several different characters leading up to that moment, and they all happen to be there in the hotel in 1968. And I watched the movie, and I was bawling and I was crying. And you're not crying because of the assassination. At the end of the movie, you're just crying for the loss.
Yeah.
This deep, profound loss for what we lost on that day, the whole country.
Yeah.
So I'm watching the movie, and I thought, I love the structure.
Yeah.
So I said, can I write a book? Could I transfer that structure to the written word?
Mm-hmm.
Could I do that? So it was a challenge. I thought, I would love to be, I like to challenge myself with each book.
Mm-hmm.
I never write the same thing, and I never write about the same thing. And I love structure. I like playing with time and POV. And so I said, could I do that? And I could have picked any number of events that changed our world, right? I could have picked, I mean, and I considered Pearl Harbor, the stock market crash, women getting the right to vote. I mean, there's so many events that have just shifted, seismically shifted our history.
Yeah.
And then I just said, well, why don't I pick one I remember? And that was how I decided to choose 9/11.
Yeah. My brain is still trapped up on this idea that it's being categorized as historical fiction because you're right,
I know,
it's so
right?
present in our
consciousness.
I know,
but you know, the other day I was talking to a friend of mine who also wrote a 9/11 book. And another interesting fact is there suddenly are a lot. There are several books that have recently come out, and it makes me wonder if it's just time. Like,
yeah.
Have we enough distance that suddenly we can talk about it and maybe talk about it easier in children's literature? Because there's something a little more simplistic, a little less graphic. You know, I had to be less graphic. I wonder if that's not what's happening. But I was talking to my friend Gay Paulsner, and her book is The Memory of Things, which is a YA about 9/11. And we realized that when we were studying the Holocaust, it had only happened 25, 26 years earlier.
Yeah, right.
And it was ancient history to me.
Right.
I was reading about it, and I didn't realize that that time altered my world.
Right.
To me, it was just history. So for these kids, it's that distant. And yeah, it's hard to wrap your brain around, isn't it?
It is. Because, it doesn't feel like 15 years ago. But you do bring up a good point that I had wanted to talk about, which is, when is it the right time to write? And I feel like, you know, in your own personal life, if you're writing about events in a memoir, it really does take 10 or 15 or 20 years to digest whatever it was that happened to you to have the perspective to write about it. And I think 9/11 is a good example of that, too, that you really need kind of some perspective in order to wrap your narrative arc around, you know, the events and write about it from a, I don't know, objective point of view.
No, you're right. Just time to heal or get over the shock.
Yeah.
I've gotten some really powerful reactions when I read from the book or talk to teachers or students or just adults. People start crying.
Yeah.
And I have this kind of working theory, I don't know if it's accurate or anything, but that people who didn't directly lose someone, who didn't actually lose a loved one, haven't really processed 9/11 the way those who did lose someone did. And maybe we felt the survivor's guilt. This is a working theory.
That's interesting.
People start crying, and I started crying when I was researching the book. So, like I said, I was thinking of it as a structural idea. I was intrigued by the concept of several different stories. I was very intrigued by the idea of several different characters who never meet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the premise of the book. None of the four characters know each other. So I was really intrigued. Could I pull that off? And then I start doing my research, which was enormous, because you also have to realize never before in history has a historic event been so documented.
Mm.
I mean, there isn't a split second that hasn't been recorded, including the number of seconds that you heard the banging of the towers as they collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's been recorded. So I had to do this really deep research, and I started crying. You know, I was watching YouTube videos of the a CNN, you know, scroll at the bottom, and as the reporters are talking, nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm crying. I feel this pain in my throat and in my chest, and I start crying, and I was very surprised. Because I didn't realize I had such a visceral, deep pain still left.
I think that's a really interesting idea about the survivor's guilt. I hadn't thought of that. That's
I don't know.
Something
you
to
know,
that.
Throw it around. I'm not you know, a sociologist or anything, but people have been very moved and having very strong reactions. Not children, obviously, but adults.
Yeah. And you made the point in the book, I can't remember if it was in the author's note or in the text itself, it's probably in the author's note, about it kind of didn't matter how far away, you know, normally proximity makes a difference, your geography to the event that happened, or if you knew somebody who died, or, and you said
yes.
Those things kind of fell away in this situation, where it didn't matter if you were in Seattle or someplace, that it really collectively
exactly.
drew
yeah,
us
Yeah, you
together.
Remembered it was Seattle. That's right.
Yeah.
yes, that's in the text. That's in the end of the book. That was another, thing that occurred to me was this event affected the entire country almost simultaneously, because one, we were watching it live, and two, nobody knew what was really happening. Do you remember,
yeah.
you know, first we were told it was an accident.
Right.
It was a small plane.
Right.
And so everyone was watching it live, and people were afraid all over the country. And there were teachers who came up to me, have come up to me recently, and told me amazing stories. Like a teacher was told, don't let your children drink the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a fear that it was poisoned. One teacher was told, you can't let your children go outside today.
Mm-hmm.
So everywhere, Texas
everywhere,
and
yeah.
Ohio. And so, yes, people living close to New York and the Pentagon probably obviously lost more lives, but the entire country was affected pretty much equally in that regard in trauma.
Well, and the aftershocks of the anthrax scares and the don't get in the subways
right.
and, you know, and the things that were going to happen on anniversaries. And, you know, I mean, we were all just living in terror. I had just given birth right when this had happened. She was 2 weeks old. And I do wonder if it kind of shifts your perspective on parenting and, you know, thinking that you've brought somebody into a very dangerous world. And,
yes,
you know, it does change the way you look at everything. It kind of changes the, you know, how
it
safe
did,
you
but
feel.
If you remember, my kids were older. They were the age of the characters in my book. We felt nothing was ever going to be the same. We the parents huddled together, and we thought this was, like you're saying, what world are we bringing our children into, and the terror and fear. And yet, look.
Yeah.
You know, we did. Here we are. We survived, and not only that, you know, we've. Well, I don't know what our political climate is right now.
Right.
but in terms of just our children don't know any different.
Right. No, that's
you know,
right.
You know, this is the world they are growing. Your child is now growing up in. For them, it's the norm. The norm is now these words are in our vocabulary. Homeland security, terrorism, bin Laden, you know, their world is going to an airport and taking off their shoes.
That's right. That's right.
They don't know. Or going to the post office and being asked, you know, does this contain whether the hazardous materials? And you know, we didn't have that.
Yeah, that's
right. And we walked to the airport gate and said goodbye to our loved ones or picked them up.
We're very adaptive as a species, which is
right.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
We have short memories.
And we have short memories, which is either good or bad. We could argue about that.
It's usually right, usually bad. But
right.
Yes, which is maybe sort of why I was writing this book. You know, as an artist and a writer, you feel the need to reflect the society you're living in and changes in it and important, you know, I don't want to say philosophies, but important moments, important
Yeah.
losses.
Right. Seismic shifts in your perspective as a nation. It is
yes.
powerful to write about collective pain. You know, so many novels are about individual pain that you can then extrapolate into individual experiences. But this was really a collective event that we all shared in, you know, some of us more equally than others together. And there is a great power in that, I think, especially for the coming of age kids, you know, those kids in the 13, 14, they're just trying to figure out how they operate in the world and how the world operates. And then to have that rug pulled out from under them is all the more powerful, I think, at that age that your kids were when they went through this. So.
And the age of the characters in the book. Yeah, I definitely wanted it to be a collective. That was exactly what I was aiming for, this collective humanity, but with the four individual stories. You know, African-American boy in Brooklyn, a white boy in Shanksville, obviously where the plane went down, a Muslim girl in Ohio, Iranian girl, and then a Jewish girl in California whose mom is going to Cantor Fitzgerald. I also, in New York City, was laying in layers of things. I knew that my readers, you know, 11, 12, 13-year-old readers, wouldn't pick up. And that was like an interesting, you know, I was laying in facts and little clues that adults will understand.
Yes.
And the kids don't until the end of the book, and then hopefully they want to go and learn some more about it. But they don't even recognize the connection between Will in Shanksville and Flight 93.
Right.
Today I did a Skype visit, and I talk a lot to kids on Skype, or I go visit schools, and I told them the story of Flight 93 and the, you know, heroes, how they diverted the plane away from the White House. They knew nothing about it.
Wow.
And
wow.
I know. So I know I was laying in things in this book that's for middle school kids that they really wouldn't know, but hopefully they'll know now. You know, they'll put it together, or they'll ask, or they'll wonder. They'll wonder. I had a teacher say she likes to keep a list of I wonders when her students are reading a book. I wonder what the, you know. So this little boy came up to the camera and he said, I didn't know anything about the heroes of Flight 93.
Wow. Well, you're doing great service to round out the story for these kids. I want to remind our listeners that my guest this morning is Nora Raleigh Baskin. The book we're talking about today is 9/10, a September 11th story. So let's talk a little bit about choosing these four points of view, these four characters, and if any of them gave you more difficulty, if you had difficulty accessing any of the four adolescents that you chose for the book, and kind of mining out who these kids were.
Yes, I did. I could tell. Well, the easiest one, believe it or not, was Sergio Kincaid, who's the African American boy in Brooklyn, because I based Sergio's backstory on mine. So Sergio does. His mom has died, and his father's left him, and I mean, that's similar to my story. So the anger Sergio walks through the world with was very familiar to me. I just dumped my understanding of how angry you can be at authority, and also how emotional you can get when somebody's a caretaker and a caregiver. So he bumps into Gideon, who is a firefighter, and he's really drawn to him. And that's another layer I put in the book, because readers are going to know firefighters, so many died. So Sergio was actually the easiest, and in the revision, his story never changed. That was the only story that my editor didn't tear apart.
Wow.
So his story stayed the same. It's probably the most authentic emotionally to me, so that was the easiest. Yeah. And then Nahid, I was like, how can I write? I knew I had to write a Muslim character because racism exploded after 9/11. Right. So I wanted to address that. So I had to have a Muslim character, and her story changed a lot. But the way I was able to access her, I think that's what, I love that word, was watching YouTube videos of a teacher teaching her students, religious students, how to put on a hijab, and realizing that that religious teacher sounded just like my children's Hebrew school teacher. Now, I mean, I don't know how people will, you know, on either side will respond to that, but it was so powerful. She sounded just like her, and what she was telling her students, why do you wear a hijab? You know, you cover your head to remind, you remember the part in Fiddler on the Roof, or Tevye's, you know, why do we wear kippahs?
Oh,
ask the rabbi
right.
to always, or I think he just says it in the beginning song, you know, to always remind us to be closer to God. She said the same thing.
Yeah.
The hand-washing rituals and the prayer rituals and the modesty, you know, why they wear the hijab and cover up is for modesty, which is very much what an Orthodox Jewish family does.
Very
so once I mean, I always knew that was true, but when I really sat down to look at it and listen, I was really struck by that. And then all of a sudden I could be Nahid.
Yeah.
I know that world. I know that kind of love and passion connection to your heritage. So that wasn't that hard at all. Then I had Amy, who's a Jewish girl who moves from Chicago to California. So she was sort of every girl my kids knew, and I knew that was fairly easy, too. I had moved so many times as a kid, I knew what it felt like to go to a new school.
Mm-hmm.
So that was easy. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, Will was the hardest.
Oh.
Will in Shanksville. And I had to do so much research. I called the principal of Shanksville from 2001 and 2016.
Wow.
And had to learn what, because it is a real, you know, Marie, they said to me, both of them, when the plane landed in their town, they both said if it could happen here, it could happen anywhere. Because it's such a small town. I mean, I think there's like 300 or 400 people in the whole town. I know there's 300 kids from kindergarten to high school.
Wow.
And that's two towns. That's not even just one.
Wow.
So it's so tiny for the plane to have, you know, found its way there and not hurt anybody. But Will was hardest because he came from a loving family, a very non-dysfunctional family. And even though his father's died, he has a loving mom and sisters, and his community and his town, so small, so loving, so supportive.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And another hard part was trying to connect his story to the heroes of Flight 93.
Right.
Because the definition of hero is amorphous, and I was trying to draw a connection. It was very difficult.
That was really lovely. I thought that was a really lovely part of the book, how you did that. Which I marveled at.
It's black and white. I mean,
it's not black
and white. It's gray. You know, what is a hero? You know, and if you don't survive it, and you don't actually save everyone's life, you're still a hero. You know, it was a hard. I grappled with it a lot.
Yeah. We're drawing down on our time, but I really wanted to talk about sort of guidelines for young. I mean, you've written so many wonderful books for young adults, and kind of if you have any internal guidelines for writing either about, you know, the details and descriptions of atrocity you had mentioned earlier this hour, about not being able to be too horrific with kids, too graphic mm-hmm. with kids. And I was wondering if you sort of have an internal set point at this point after 13 books of because you can't write down to kids, and kids are more sophisticated than maybe a lot of people give them credit for. Kind of how you find the right voice for this age group, and, you know, if there's editing out of stuff and kind of how you write.
Yeah,
for
no,
this age
it's
group.
A good question, because for middle grade now, I guess the biggest thing I did was choose not to have anybody die. And I don't mind giving that away in the book at all. For parents to know or kids to know, none of the main characters dies or loses anybody. And that was a huge decision. That was really deliberate. So, yes, when I'm writing for 4th, 5th, 6th graders, 7th, I'd say this book is 4th to 7th grade.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I think really strongly about what I don't want a kid to have to unsee. You know, parents are worried about what their kids are learning, so you want them to learn about the events, but I didn't want anything horrific, really graphic in their minds. If you were writing YA, it would be very different.
Yeah.
If you're writing for the high school, 8th, 9th, 10th grade level, you can show more. But basically, in the publishing world, you can't have bad words.
Yeah.
And there's certain, actually the publishers have a lot of stipulations.
Okay.
So those rules are in place already.
Okay.
But you're right, you don't want to talk down.
Right.
And but I did make the choice not to. I think the biggest choice I made for this book was there was enough loss in the story itself, in the backstory, in the history, in the premise.
Exactly.
That I didn't need to have anyone die.
Exactly.
It's sad enough. You know?
It's sad enough. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
And to your point about having to do all of this research because everything is so incredibly well documented, it's a very fine line to walk about writing about 9/11 in the collective consciousness that we all have about it, but the children you're writing for don't have it. And that was a really elegant line to not, you know, rehash too much of what we already know, but to put in enough details in there so that kids get it and the kids who haven't lived through it really understand it and get it. That's tough.
And kids will look for what they, and kids know themselves. If they want more information, they'll look, they'll seek it out and they'll find it. And if they don't, they won't. You know, they have a good internal meter for what they can and can't handle.
Yeah, right, right. I have about 100,000 more questions here on four pieces of paper. And now we're out of time. Are there things that we left? I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff we left out, but is there last minute advice that you'd like to give writers of young adult fiction or writers in general that has sustained you throughout the 13 novels you've written?
Well, yes, I would say always never write to a trend, never look for an event or something, you know, to fill a gap or try to fit in the market. Always write what's in your heart and not try to get, not to fill. A lot of people think there's a trend, there's vampires or there's dystopian or maybe 9/11. I would say 99.9% of the time that's not going to work. Not only that, by the time you write it and get someone to see it, that trend is over.
Yeah.
So always write from your heart. Always write what interests you and what you deeply care about. And if you're good and, you know, if you've developed enough skill and you deeply care about something, I think it'll be good and someone will like it.
I really think that's fantastic advice because I can't tell you how many people that I talk to that are like, vampire, you're right, vampires are hot or something.
Yeah,
you're right. And I
it's
had
true.
Read something you said along the way about the older you get, the less you are kind of wedded to mining material from your own life and you have more of an outward perspective on, you know, writing about, I don't know, a broader range or a broader spectrum of things. I thought that was a really interesting observation.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Well, my first, 10 novels were all me sort of exercising my own life. I told you, gave you a little hint about what it was like for me, and I did that. And now, maybe it's just being in my 50s. I feel, and my kids being grown, I feel more, like there's more mothering in me and more, and so, like my last book was about a girl whose mom's incarcerated at Bedford Hills in New York, and yeah, I feel a little more outward.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of children out there, not just mine, and not just me. Hopefully I grew up.
I love that. I love that. And we can find you online. I know you're on Facebook, and you're on norabaskin.com.
And Twitter.
And Twitter.
At Nora Raleigh B. Yeah, Nora Raleigh B at Twitter. Yeah. Twitter's great.
Twitter is great.
Twitter's been amazing.
And your website is great. There's a lot of information about you, your books, and everything else on your website. So I highly recommend our listeners to go there to find out more about you. But Nora, this was such a huge pleasure.
You.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. You're wonderful. I felt so comfortable.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
My goal.
I feel like I've known you for years and years, and this is really wonderful. So
me too. It's a good book to bond over for everybody, I think.
Thank you.
We are going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Alexander Weinstein will be here in the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. You can find us, you can find podcasts of all of our shows on iTunes. Check us out on iTunes College Radio. And if you can't find us there, you can certainly find us on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. There's a lot of direct downloads, past shows, upcoming shows, No Reason Not to Listen to Us There. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. We are back with Alexander Weinstein. He is the director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and the author of the short story collection Children of the New World, which is out now. It's published by Picador. Actually, technically, I think it's actually out next week. It will be published by Picador, but if you're listening to us via podcast, run to your bookstore right now because it is out. His fiction and translations have appeared in Cream City Review, Hayden's Ferry, all over the place, the Notre Dame Review, other places. He is the recipient of a Sustainable Arts Foundation Award, and his fiction has been awarded the... a lot of stuff. I just want to talk to him, so I'm not going to go through all of his awards, but he's won lots of awards. He's been nominated for Pushcart Prizes, and he's in a few different anthologies. He is the Associate Professor of Creative Writing and a freelance editor leading the Ficshop workshops in the U.S. and Europe. Alexander, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
I'm going wild for this collection, as all of my followers on Facebook know, and I want to dive into it, but I'm going to let you kind of introduce us to it first. It is a book sort of the future. It's very personal to me because I have a very technologically engaged family that sometimes terrifies me, so I kind of went into a little funk after reading all these
stories. Right. We all do. Technological families and friends right now.
Right. So take us into Children of the New World. Take us into the future here.
Sure. So it's a short story collection that deals primarily with people trying to live good lives in a society or in a world that's technologically gone sort of over the edge, right? And so you have parents burying robotic children that malfunction and mourning over them. You have people living completely online lives, and their avatars get STDs, and they have to deal with that. There's a second ice age that sweeps through, and you have poor people living in single igloos, and then one rich guy living in a double-decker igloo and burning up all the wood. Right? So there's humor in there, but also a lot of dystopic sort of futures, near futures, that I'm working with.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of short story collections, a lot of short story writers, they write their 10 to 13 stories, and then they look across those 13 for themes that sort of hold them together and put them in a collection. This feels like you had the theme, and then you wrote the stories to that theme. And I don't know if that's true or not, but maybe you can talk to that.
Yeah, you know, it sort of came on by surprise, because the first story, which is the first story that opens the collection, Saying Goodbye to Yang, I hadn't really been writing in a speculative vein yet. And then my computer crashed about 10 years ago, and it took a lot of my work with it. Mm. And it was very emotionally disturbing for me, right? And I was kind of very distraught over this computer dying. And around the same time, my students were all talking about how much they loved their iPhones and, you know, how they'd be lost if they didn't have their iPhone. So I realized we were forging these emotional connections with our technology. And that led to Saying Goodbye to Yang, where, of course, there's Yang who malfunctions in there. And that then opened up the world to, for me, a whole new sort of world of short stories that I could work with, where I was, you know, making fun of my own bumbling attempts to navigate this new world of technology, and then also deal with, I think, a lot of the fears that we all have or the emotions that we haven't yet dealt with that are caused by new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't as plotted out in many ways, but the stories just kept coming to me, right? And there was all this technology is moving so quickly in the last 10 years that there were all these new sort of nuances of how to get at, how do we deal with this suddenly this world of Google Glass, you know, that's come and passed, but Pokemon Go, for example, which is completely absurd, but everybody is suddenly looking at their devices.
Yep. You know, what I really thought was powerful in a lot of so much was powerful, but this juxtaposition of very human, natural things against technology. So you have, you know, all the things that make us the most essentially human of, you know, love and sex and nature and emotion, then juxtaposed against all of, you know, virtual reality and androids and virtual sex and, you know, all of these I just thought that that tension was so alive in each one of these, and really brought it off the page of what, you know, it really makes you question what makes us who we are, what makes us human, what separates us from androids, or what will in the near, hopefully not too near term future. But, you know, I think that that's a power. I assume that that was a very conscious decision on your part to put these very human things against very technological concepts.
Yeah, I mean, I care a lot about humanity, right? And I care about, I'm a father and a son, of course, and have friends and all of these things where I think in many ways we work to become better, hopefully, most of us, right? To love well, to be good parents, to be good friends, to be there to help support the community. And that, to me, in many ways, stands to some degree in opposition to where technology takes us. I'm thinking here of, like, virtual communities, right? There's a way that we're all engaged in these virtual communities, whether it be Facebook or Instagram or dating apps or, you know, any of this. And yet, over time, it becomes that sometimes we have less and less community, right, actual community,
right,
and much more virtual community, right, or we become, like, poor competitors for the acquaintances that are texting at the dinner table in front of us, right? And this sort of human separation that I see happening all the while technology is telling us and social networks are telling us we're becoming more connected and globally, you know, we're a global world now, and that's true to some degree, but this question of what about our real community? What about our environments? What about the nature and the natural world, which is definitely taking a hit right now.
Yeah.
Right?
So what's your relationship? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say what your relationship is with all of this now. Does it drive you away from it, or especially as a father?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing, right? So I have a 13-year-old son who's totally connected, right? And as most 13-year-olds are, and in some ways, you know, I'm semi-hypocritical, right? I use the internet all the time, and in fact, this is what drives a lot of the basis for my stories. Is I realize, wow, I'm checking my email now 10 times, 20 times, 30 times a day, where once upon a time maybe you checked it once, right, in the day. Now it's all the time.
Yeah.
And I have Netflix and watch Hulu and you name it, right? So I'm involved in that. But I am starting to try to step away more, you know, so that I leave my phone home, which feels totally suddenly scary, right? Even though once upon a time we all lived that way and we had answering machines. Now to leave the phone at home when I go out is like a big challenge, right? And I can't wait. I feel this, like, nervousness. Can I go back and check? Can I see who texted me, right? So I'm making fun of myself in this, too, and I think we're all at this place, right? When I stop at a red light, I look over and people are, like, trying to send off one last text before the light turns green or, you know, update a post on a smoothie or God knows what they're doing, right? And I'm doing it, too. I find myself that at the red light, I'm like, oh, I can, you know, I can answer an email in 1 minute. So I have to stop that in many ways. I think that somehow detaching, and then in the case of my son, setting up times. We don't have any screen time anymore, right? This is now we go out to nature, right, which isn't boring, and we're not going to look for Pokemon in nature. We're actually just going to, like, breathe and walk in the woods or something.
Right, right.
So that's sort of my fraught connection with technology.
Yeah, all of our fraught connection. Yeah, I mean, there's such a ripple effect through a lot of these stories about addiction and what we're addicted to, and it is an addiction. I mean, I do think you're right. We get fidgety and twitchy when we're away from it. And, well, you know, that's sort of the dictionary definition of addiction.
Of addiction, right.
Speaking.
Yeah, and then, I mean, in many of the stories, the characters, I think, are trying to get away from that in some way.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fully able to. But there's, like, glimmers of hope all throughout that suddenly in the burying of their electronic equipment, they realize that they're still a family, right? Or they realize the neighbor, in the case of that first story, saying goodbye to Yang, there's a connection with the neighbor there. There's this kind of underlying current of human interaction, and that, of course, the title story really speaks to that.
Yeah.
That human interaction is all there is, right? And we've kind of gotten deluded by the technology, but there is hope there, right, that somehow the families will come back together and make a little step towards that.
Well, and we're all still essentially human. I mean, the things that drive us, maybe it's now driving us online, but the primary core of who we are, I think, is still humming in there. It's just how we get to it, right, and how we satisfy it. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that, you know, that's in many ways the hope of the collection, or that, you know, while it's dystopian to a certain extent, I don't think it's completely pessimistic. You know, I think it's hopeful in that I, again, believe in humanity and trying to show that I think human love and caring is always there, right? Well, I mean, depends on where you look, of course. Donald Trump is running for president presently, and I'm not sure how much human love is there, but you have exceptions to the rule, so to speak. But in the most part, people are trying to be good.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Alexander Weinstein. I'm saying your name, yes, correct?
Yes.
I hate it when I say names wrong. Children of the New World is the book. I want to shift a little bit to some crafty questions. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this was your play with form, and what the short story is capable of, what it can do, and different ways to look at it. There's one story in here that are dictionary entries, new language given to the new world. There's a journal article, sort of an academic journal kind of style article with, if you think a short story can't have footnotes, you're wrong, it can. But I really enjoyed this play with form. I was wondering if you kind of gave yourself different challenges, or if you just enjoy playing with different structures of the story, or talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the majority of the stories are ultimately traditional narratives, right? Yeah. While they're experimental stories, the stories we've been talking about so far, like saying Goodbye to Yang or Children of the New World, they follow the classic plot arcs and character development and conflict model of narrative. But I'm very interested in breaking the rules, and I love authors who break those rules, right? And so I've tried, I'm constantly trying new forms. Like, I love this idea of writing in the dictionary form, right? Or writing, recently I was just doing postcards, fictional postcards, and just sending them out to people, right? And so I think that there's, when you choose to work in formalism, you suddenly have all these new challenges and all these new voices you can play with, because, of course, you're trying to some degree, satirize a voice that's already out there. In the case of the dictionary, I mean, it's very, very formal. There's a lot of rules to that dictionary form. It's a tight form. But within that, those limitations, suddenly there's all this experimentation that it opens up. And the other thing that I find fascinating about specifically the dictionary story is that it no longer follows the traditional plot arc. Mm-hmm. Characters are done away with in some ways. Even though they appear, you're not following a main character. There's not a kind of central conflict. And so the effect of the story comes sort of through these mini-stories, right? It's a kind of building of effect over time through the different pieces. And how do you begin to then sculpt a beginning, middle, and end when you don't have the narrative, classic narrative, arc there? And I'm still sort of finding out about these forms as I explore them, because each one seems to come with its own rules, right, its own expectations. And then also this idea that there's a whole different way to create an effect for a reader than the traditional narrative. That's fascinating to me. So I constantly give myself different forms or experiments to play with.
Yeah, really, really fun. Yeah. And I just enjoy thinking about different ways to tell a story. That was really great. I also was thinking, and, you know, it's hard to, there's a story about two-thirds of the way through the collection called Rocket Knight. It's hard to read that. For me, it was hard to read it without thinking of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. And I was wondering if there are sort of short story archetypes in your head that you think you sometimes draw from, or you say, you know, that was an interesting story, let me try and twist it this way, or it was completely organic and I'm totally off base here.
Yeah, you know, it is more organic where then I realize what I'm doing in retrospect. Right, so Jackson's The Lottery is definitely a model of which I'm referencing in there. In fact, one of the students who sent off in the first paragraph, her last name's Jackson, so there's a kind of call out
right.
To that, right? I'm kind of referencing that there. But, for example, that story wherein this school community gathers together to send the least liked child into space, which is horrific, right? Never to come back, right? They just send off the kids. That really had to do with bullying for me in many ways. And my son was in elementary school, and he was dealing with some bullying, and I didn't necessarily feel like the administrators or the teachers were doing the right job, and it reminded me of bullying when I was a kid. And so I was thinking, yeah, how can I reproduce this story, right? And so then there was this sort of gleeful community that's just sending off the least liked kids to disappear as metaphor for what we do in bullying, how we can turn our backs on our children or even collaborate sometimes to ostracize or shun the least liked kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so it wasn't, in some ways, I wasn't really like reading Shirley Jackson's The Lottery next to it. I wasn't doing anything like that, but it was in the back of my mind.
Right.
Similarly, in Ice Age, there's the scene where he goes down through the ice, down underneath to find the houses that are frozen in the ice below, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking very much about Calvino during that time.
Mm.
There's sort of these fantastical landscapes and how to sort of, for myself as a writer, get lost in the fantasy of that for a moment and really enjoy the landscape, kind of explore it alongside the characters. So I think that I borrow, or the footnotes, I mean, David Foster Wallace is certainly an inspiration and showed so much about experimentation to me. And so I was thinking of him and how does he use the footnotes. But it comes sort of secondary, where I'm already halfway into the story and then I'm like, oh, yes, right, that's who I'd like to borrow from.
Interesting.
Yeah, one other thought about that is like migration. There's a scene where the father and the son, the teenage son who, you know, just wants to go bicycle riding in this world where nobody goes outside anymore because of everybody's online and has avatars. And so the son goes bicycle riding, and the dad finds him, and they have this sort of heart-to-heart, it's a very difficult conversation. And there I was thinking about Baldwin's Sonny's Blues. And I did go back to Sonny's Blues and look at the dialogue and how do you deal with two characters who are trying to reach each other, who have love for one another, but can't quite talk. Mm. And so I really kind of looked at him to learn how to do that scene. Mm.
That's great. There's a favoring of first person, certainly not all of them, but the majority of them are sort of first person, starting off at least in present tense. And I felt like that really gave a wonderful immediacy and deep access to characters who are, sometimes have a hard time accessing themselves, or are kind of looking for themselves. I thought the first person present tense was a nice choice. Is that seem where you're most comfortable?
You know, for this collection, it was. And I noticed it as I wrote, again, in retrospect, I said, whoa, everything's in first person, right? Whereas the collection I'm working on now, the second collection, there's a lot more third-person distant omniscience going on and what I call fourth-person perspective, which is a kind of collective we without there being an I.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't, again, it wasn't as conscious as suddenly I said, oh, okay, great, these are all first-person. I think it fits probably because so many of my characters are struggling in this world and they haven't figured out how to deal with the technology yet, right, or the environmental disaster or everything that they're finding. And there's somehow that this voice of these semi-lost characters that are just trying to find their way worked really well in first. I just heard their voices whenever I'd sit down to write. I could hear them talking about their problems. And so in many ways, I just put the pen to paper and sort of followed what they had to say.
That's great.
But in general, I, you know, as I was writing it, I said, what about third person? Where's my third person stories? And I was really happy when a third person story suddenly would pop up. But for some reason, the characters seemed to want to talk in first.
It's funny because one of the third person stories was the Moksha, which is a search for enlightenment. And I thought that's funny that one of the few stories that is in third person is this personal search for enlightenment. I thought, that kind of says something interesting.
Yeah, what do you make of that? That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You're right. And actually, the other Buddhist story is also third person.
Third person, right. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, fascinating. Right.
I love it.
You have a theory on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have to reflect on it more and think about what it means, but it did jump out at me.
That's yeah.
And tell me, when do you know, are there stories that you had to let go that didn't, kind of how far you get into a story when you realize it has legs, or do you always see it through to the end, or do you let things go if it's not working out?
I tend to at least try to get all the way through the end of the first draft. Right? And so as far as my drafting process goes, my stories go through at least 8 to 12 drafts before they even print it out, and then I start doing the editing on them, right? So they're already being drafted loads of times. And so the first draft I'm always writing by hand. And usually most stories will either, I mean, sometimes I'm writing it by hand and I just realize I hit a dead end and the story isn't either, it's not ready, or it's just not functional. Something's off in it. But it tends to be that I'll get it to the page and I'll start working it. And maybe I'll work it for, I mean, most of my stories have a gestation period of 6 months to a year before they're done.
Hmm.
And then I start sending them out, right? Or then I start publishing them. And I tend to work maybe 5 stories or 6 stories at a time. So they're all in different stages. And sometimes I don't know that they're not working until much later. It took me 6 months. I think it's great. And then 3 months later, I look at it and say, nope, something's off.
Wow.
And then that may mean that, great, that was practice. Goodbye story, thank you, right? And I just let it go. In other cases, I'm missing a piece. So, for example, Heartland in the collection, which is the story where everyone's selling off the topsoil, right? And it's kind of a horrible environmental problem that people are having where they're selling off their own land. That I only had half finished, and it then sat there for 2 years. I didn't know what to do with it. And suddenly the BP oil spill happened. And it was such a horrific time. I mean, we were watching on the news, right? It's day 65 of the oil spill, and nothing's happening, right? And we just watched oil being... It was so horrific to me that, you know, I came up with that idea of an endless oil spill that's just going on. And that suddenly gave me the tone of the character and the kind of world situation. I just needed that detail.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finished Heartland. And it actually changed tone. It started as, if you can believe it, as a funny story when you read this, or it's this incredibly depressing story. But it actually started as a humor story, and then it was that emotion of watching the BP oil spill that changed the whole story years later.
Incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's a great lesson for writers, I think. The other thing that
Go ahead. I think having that loose connection or that loose feeling around stories in some ways is that they don't always have to be these precious objects, right, and that they might just be practice stories, or they may just be waiting for a moment and having, I guess, patience with them. Another story that had that was Openness, where there's that psychic technology where, you know, there are layers and we can let people psychically into these layers. I had that technology down and fully understood the technology that would end up being in the story. I think it was about 3 years before the story was finished.
Wow.
And I didn't know how to place it, right? And I was like, it's great technology. I don't know where the story is. And then suddenly a love relationship and the trials and tribulations of a love relationship I was in gave me all the characters and the plot place the technology into.
Amazing. One thing that I wanted to ask you about, I'm probably opening a whole can of worms here when we don't have time for it, but if there is something you can say about establishing the rules of how the world works for science fiction, because it has to be done so quickly and not didactically and incredibly organically, do you have any tips or tricks or something that you could say about how you set up the world so that the reader understands what's going on without it being laborious?
Yeah, I do. I have some ways that I approach it. One is to never explain too much, right? Because, for example, if I'm writing a realistic story and I mention he picked up his cell phone or she picked up her cell phone, I'm not going to say the cell phone was invented in, you know, whenever it was invented and it's a cordless phone. Da, da, da. I mean, people would think I was crazy if I wrote like that. It would be very bad writing because we all are familiar with how cell phones work. And so in science fictional universes or speculative fiction universes, going with the premise that everybody already understands what this technology is, even though the reader doesn't yet, right?
Okay.
So it's kind of dropping the characters in, letting them function with this alternate, whether it's technology or landscape or whatever it is, and having that become background rather than foreground. Right? So the technology is just there. It's what the characters are using in the case of these stories. And then the trick is to make sure that it's clear, right? Which is a little bit of sleight of hand, because for me, I want to avoid big chunks of paragraphs where I'm explaining how the technology works. That's that whole cell phone problem.
Yeah.
And so it's usually through context, right, that you can then establish, that's how that works, right? And so you give little pieces. It's a matter of giving little pieces along the way and making sure you give enough of those pieces that the reader can then put it all together.
Yeah, yeah. I think the best way to learn how to do this is to just read your stories and see how you do it, because it's really very masterful. I mean, I just think it probably takes a lot of practice of trial and error, and probably a lot of overwriting and then cutting, I would imagine.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of making a mess in drafts, and when I teach, I encourage my students to overwrite. So many of my stories had those very long passages, right? Until I learned to stop doing that. But I still, when I write the drafts, I often have unnecessary sections where I then see, this section is really just trying to do something functional.
Yeah.
It's trying to instruct, it's trying to take care of some sort of exposition. And when I can see that, I know that it probably can be removed, or that it needs to be made more invisible through the scene doing much more than just giving information.
Right.
And this is where characters then come in. And so usually characters can take care of that, because they have actual problems of their lives to talk about on the page, of which the technology is causing, but they're not, you know, in the case of my story, the technology is causing this, but they're not aware of that yet.
Exactly.
Or they're only semi-aware.
And it's not the main drive of the story. You're right. It's the background of the story, and the character's plight is the driving force. I think that's key to making it come alive and not seeing so preachy of, you know, how we got here and what it all means. That's great. Is there anything that we should have talked about that we didn't talk about? We're drawing down on our time, but I don't know if you have advice for writers that we didn't cover that has helped you.
Well, I think, you know, a couple of the things that I mentioned was, right, this idea of precious objects and trying to not have those, right? I mean, of course, all stories are precious to us, and poems and whatnot, but having this kind of lighter connection, I think for me so this was a 10-year collection, the earliest story I wrote 10 years ago. And there came points during this journey wherein I realized I wasn't having fun anymore, right? Even this was with success. There's also some advice to writers is get ready for rejection and get ready for all of that, right? There's loads and loads of rejection, and not to take that too seriously, right?
Yeah.
But I've been having success, and yet I started realizing, wow, I'm not having fun within my stories. And this can happen, I think, to writers, where you're worried so much about publication, or you're worried about your craft, or you're dealing with the inner critic, right, that's telling you, why are you even writing in the first place? Shouldn't you do something productive with your life, or however people's inner critics talk to them?
Yeah, right.
And so I really believe in one, getting the inner critic out of the room when we're writing, right, so that we can rediscover just the playfulness of it. Because I think as writers, we came to it because of the joy and the exploration. And maybe it's not always joy or fun. You know, some people need to write because they have a truth to tell, or they have a story to tell that may be a kind of healing, or it may be very painful. So fun isn't quite the right word there, but there's a need to do something.
Right.
And I think the inner critic can get in the way of that. And so for me, you know, I'd mentioned the postcard exercise. That was a lot of fun, and that started to let me play again. And I really, when I teach, I often teach, you know, allow yourself free time to play and explore the imagination on the page, because I think that's where the really beautiful work will come from.
I love it. I love it. Alexander Weinstein, I'm such a fan. This was so wonderful. I can't. So you're working on another collection. Are you sticking with short stories?
I am. The next collection I'm working on right now is falls really kind of into novel slash short stories, in that it's a fictional tour guide to impossible destinations, right? So museums of heartbreak and hotels of love and all sorts of different fantastical settings. And it's in the form of a tour guide, right, for people that want to go to these places.
I love it.
And so it's again, speculative fiction, but in this case, not necessarily sci-fi at all, much more in the realm of Calvino or Borges.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I can't wait. I will be following you. We can find you. You have a great website. We can follow you online. I think it's your name, yeah?
That's right, AlexanderWeinsteinFiction.com.
Perfect. And I know you're on Facebook, and you're probably elsewhere.
I am.
And I know you have a massive book tour coming up. I'm thinking of making the whole journey up to L.A. I never go up to L.A., but I'm thinking of
that would be fantastic.
Making the long drive to Book Soup just to see you next month. So that'll be, you're all over the place. Well, thank you so much. This was
looking forward to the book tour and everything.
You're all over the place. You're good. Yeah, you're going to some great, great places. So if you were listening to us from outside the L.A. area, check out Alexander's website. He's going to be all over. So this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Well, pleasure for me too. Thanks so much.
That was Alexander Weinstein. The book is Children of the New World. It will be out next week in time for the release of this podcast. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.